This week on the BOAG World Show, we're joined by Carl Racky, the founder of Proposify, to talk about his life as a successful entrepreneur. This week's show is sponsored by Packly and the Digital Project Manager School. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG. Joining me, obviously, is Marcus Lillington. But we're also being joined by Carl Racky. Hello, Carl. Good to have you on the show.
Oh, it's an incredible honor to be on the show. I listened to this podcast, I think, 10 years ago. I was an avid listener, and it's just surreal getting to talk to the celebrities themselves.
Yeah, not so much, but we've talked via email a few times, haven't we? Because you've been a sponsor on this show in the past, and also I was a user when you were like in early beta, I think.
Yes, and then you left us for Quiller, I think. Ooh. It was.
Hey,
I wasn't going to mention their name. You're obviously very bitter about it.
You've also been on my podcast twice.
Yes, of course. I forgot that. Very true. Well, it's about time I returned the favor, isn't it, really?
Absolutely. Well, the real celebrity I was talking about was Marcus.
Yeah. This is true.
Yeah. Well, that
absolutely
is true.
But yeah. It still freaks me out. Occasionally it happens. If I go to a conference, a webby conference, people will come up to me and say, "Are you Marcus?" It's because they've heard my voice over the years, and it freaks me out every single time. I'm not famous at all. I once was, maybe, but no. Paul's the star, aren't you, Paul? I'm enjoying watching you squirm.
Oh, yes.
That's great.
The one that freaked me out the most was on a tube in London. That I was on a tube train, and I was with Andy Clark and John Hicks, I think. And we were just chatting away, and this voice behind me said, "Excuse me," and you know what it's like on a tube. You think, oh, it's going to be someone begging or some weirdo or, you know. So I ignored them. And then they said, "Paul." And I thought, where have they read that on me? What's on me that says my name? And it was somebody that had heard us on the podcast and recognized my voice. So, yes, that was very freaky.
I told him to go away, of course. Even, yeah.
Oh, just obviously.
Turned his back. Didn't say anything.
No, actually, I enjoyed every. I enjoyed every minute of it because Andy Clark and John Hicks, who are incredibly well known in their fields, thought it was, you know, that were obviously deeply envious that I got recognised and they didn't. So yeah, there you go. So anyway, Carl, the reason that we've got you on the show. It's because you, my man, have lived the dream that you were an agency person and now you're this entrepreneur conquering the world. So tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about Proposify as well.
Sure, yeah. It was a dream for a long time. So I'm a designer by trade. That's what I went to school for, and I worked in agencies for most of my career in the early days. And then around 2009, I went out on my own and launched my own web design agency, which, as I'm sure you know and everybody knows, is a very difficult business, especially if you don't know what you're doing, which I
still
know.
Don't.
But I was always interested in SaaS, and I was an early user of Basecamp. And I remember when I was working at an agency, I always had this sort of just idea for, you know, wouldn't it be cool if there was a Basecamp for proposal writing? Because I sensed there was a lot of pain there, you know, in agencies I worked at and running my own business. And it was an idea I kind of wireframed drunk in my basement one night, kind of sat on it for a number of years. And then as we were running the agency and experiencing a lot of the struggles with cash flow and clients and collecting on invoices, Kevin is my business partner, we just really wanted to start experimenting with some product ideas to try to build a SaaS company. And a lot of them, all of them failed except for the proposal idea, which, you know, users tended to really gravitate towards. So we just kept focusing on it and eventually sold the agency business and went out and worked full-time on Proposify.
That's cool.
So to give people a bit more of an idea of the kind of thing that Proposify does, I mean, obviously it produces proposals, but why so this bit is going to sound like an ad, but explain to people why you would want that over doing it, I don't know, in Word or InDesign or whatever.
Sure. So, you know, there's two things there. One is the act of creating proposals is typically time-consuming and painful for a lot of people. So Proposify helps just streamline the creation of proposals using templates, using a content library, using variables that auto-replace or auto-switch out stuff like the client name so you don't have to do find and replace. And obviously the collaboration aspect makes that easier. So what we try to do as a company is take the time it takes to write proposals down. Obviously, if you're spending less time on a proposal, you can put that time into client work or closing deals. And then from the client standpoint, it's just a more impressive way to receive a proposal. Instead of getting a PDF in your inbox, clients get this nice interactive link that they can, you know, interact with prices, watch videos, and sign online. So we just kind of take the creation to close and make that shorter and more beautiful.
Now, there's some really interesting stuff in there. I mean, the one that is a particular one for me that it actually Quilla, that is the app that I use, doesn't support, which is frigging variables. And that is by far one of the most useful things. How many times have you sent out a proposal and you got the wrong frigging client name in it? And it's like so annoying, isn't it? And so embarrassing. So yeah, it's kind of, that's a very good one. You've kind of, I was looking at your website in preparation for this and your product has matured quite a lot, isn't it? Mm. You're continually investing obviously in its development.
Yeah.
I mean, there seems to be a reasonable team of you now. How many of you are there?
So we're at almost 65 full-time employees.
Wow.
So we've grown a lot in the last few years. We also raised a large round of funding last year, which you know, putting a lot of that investment dollars into growing the team.
Yeah, absolutely. Now that's really exciting. So a very different world from the world of being a developer and designer then.
Oh yeah. Though it's kind of funny because it goes full circle sometimes. Like I wanted to get out of the service business for so long and get into SaaS. And now that it's been rolling for a few years, we're moving more up market and selling to larger sales teams that use our product. And a lot of them want services. So they want us to write their proposals and offer consulting. And so now we're sort of getting roped back into that world a little bit.
That's interesting.
Isn't it funny how these things work?
Yeah.
So, Was that a conscious decision to start targeting the higher end market?
Well, I mean, this is a very common problem for SaaS companies, which is that if you target, it's perfectly all right to target very small customers paying you a small amount. We all know Basecamp has been very dedicated to never taking on enterprise customers. But there is inherent challenges that go along with serving small customers, which is namely churn. Customers canceling their subscriptions, and that becomes more of a problem as your recurring revenue grows. It gets eaten away by all of this churn that starts to develop. So a common strategy that works for a lot of SaaS companies, and it makes sense for our business, is to start going up market, targeting larger companies. And usually if you sell a higher priced product, you know, there's more involved in the sales process. It takes longer to close those deals, but your churn is relatively nothing, because once a company invests in the software, they're not going to leave.
So do you offer a kind of customized version for the bigger clients? So whatever they might particularly want the proposal software to do, your developers create that for them.
Yeah, right. It's the same product, but we have different feature sets that we move on to different tiers. So typically, as you move up market into larger sales teams, they're looking for things like advanced permissions, the ability to lock down templates and content. What Paul was talking about, variables, we offer the ability to actually create your own custom fields and variables so you can kind of have your sales rep fill in a form and then populate the proposal with content. So those types of features, advanced reporting, dashboards, those things we sell on the higher plans.
Well, I mean, I imagine there's many different types, but is there a particular type of industry that that you work in, or is it vastly different?
Yeah, you know, when we started, I made the conscious decision to focus on agencies because that was the market that I knew really well. I had been in the agency business for a long time, and I didn't want to try to sell to an industry like construction that I just know nothing about. So all of our marketing and our product was very dedicated to mostly digital agencies, and they still make up a large percentage of our customers. But we've found that as we've moved up market, it tends to be more of like IT consulting, finance, sometimes like HR payroll. I don't know why they seem to gravitate to our software. So we're finding there's a lot of industries that use our software, and it becomes less agency as you move up market.
Okay. I was expecting you to say, I don't know, IT hardware or something like that. Not, you know, like the opposite of agencies, but because I write lots of proposals and I think they're all different, but obviously they're not. Because, I just go and reinvent the wheel a lot, and maybe I should look at your software.
That's what we try to,
I've been telling you that for years, Marcus. Don't suddenly come round to that now. Carl's on show.
Marcus, all right. You commented on the software. I remember a couple of years ago, Paul was talking about Proposify on the show, and we all got really excited. And Marcus said something like he hated that you had to actually draw your signature.
Yeah, I don't like that.
With the mouse.
Yeah.
And so we changed that for you.
For me.
We added the ability to type your signature. Yeah.
Yes, and I came back to you on the show and said that because Carl emailed me back over it. And I actually said it to you, and you still, all these years later, aren't using it. I've got to say, you've added loads. I'm just looking through your site now. It's a funny thing, isn't it, that people get into SaaS from the agency side because they kind of think, oh, it's reoccurring passive income. Right? Mm-hmm. Bollocks, it's passive. You know, you know, I look now at you know, when I switched across to Quilla, and I
Third
obviously now I'm looking
that,
back
I
at it
say.
Because. Yeah, but I know. But what I'm about to say goes the other way. When I switched across to Quilla, it's because Quilla was better suited to me at the time, right? Mm. Now, if I look at it today, it's actually, I'm going, oh, perhaps I need to move back to Proposify because you've evolved and developed. And going back to what you were saying about churn, that's exactly what is happening, isn't it? Mm. So you can never stand still. There's no such thing as passive income.
Oh, no. And competition eats away at that as well. Not as much as you would think. But, yeah, certainly you're an example of smaller customers move around a lot more than larger companies. They tend to kind of stay with what they've got. So when we sell to bigger companies, usually they're not using anything. They're just using Word or you know, PowerPoint or something like that. So really the status quo is mostly what we compete against. But certainly like features become important, although we try not to just compete on features. And proposal software's been exploding over the last few years. More have been entering the market. It's been getting super competitive.
Cool. And that's always quite a scary thing, I imagine, you know, when suddenly a new competitor comes along and you think, oh, that's quite good.
It also really justifies that there's a need in the market, that more people are searching for a solution. So I think competition is a good thing. I know that sounds kind of cliched to say that, but I mean, even bigger competitors than us, like PandaDoc, who have raised a lot more money, I think they've raised $30 or $40 million. In a way, they've been helping carve out that there even is a market. So in a sense, we're kind of grateful for our competitors.
It feels like a no-brainer to me. I mean, you know, for the sake of, a few dollars per month, and I know there's a lot of for the sake of a few dollars a month, and as a small business owner, you do kind of reach the point of going, flipping heck, you know, how many more of these things am I going to be paying for? But what I will say about software like this is the one area that I will invest in terms of software is in sales and marketing. That's where, you know, I think you get a good bang for your buck. So, you know, I use Pipedrive as my CRM, and that means that I'm organized and on top of my sales. Yeah, Proposify is another great example, because, you know, it has that good first impression. It has that impact. And it also streamlines a load of stuff, because suddenly your proposal, you don't have to produce a statement of work afterwards, so that your proposal becomes your contract and all of those kinds of things. And so anything that automates the bits of my work I don't really like writing proposals, like remembering to follow up on clients, all of that kind of stuff, then yeah, I'm happy to pay a bit of money for that. It seems like a no-brainer to me.
Yeah, it's always nice when the product, you can attach it to sales, because that it really justifies the cost.
Yeah.
And I think what we fight against sometimes is people saying, well, would I really have closed that deal using your software? Would I still may have closed it if I used a Word document? So everything we're doing is trying to actually not just make creating the proposal easier, but actually influencing the buyer and trying to enhance the likelihood that they'll accept your proposal. Because then we're really saying, like, we help you close a deal.
Yeah, yeah, which is a huge part of it. Okay, let's take. I feel somewhat hypocritical, because I'm very conscious that so far what we've been talking about sounds like a massive big advert for Proposify.
Let me be clear.
No, I'm sure you don't. Proposify are not paying to be on this podcast. And now I've got to talk about a sponsor who is paying. And that is really unfair. But there you go. Such is life. This is the advantage. Ladies and gentlemen, learn the lesson. This is the advantage of networking and keeping in contact. Because me and Carl have been talking for a long time, and he's kept contact with me. Now he gets sponsorship for free.
Long game. Play the long game.
So true.
Play the long game. Smart move. Yeah. Anyway, let me talk about Digital Project Manager School. So this is an online digital project management course that you can do. It covers the whole project life cycle from initiation through to closing a project. So, you know, you've won the project using Proposify. Competition is available. And then what? You've got to deliver on the thing. So you want to do a course like this one, which is Mastering Digital Project Management. It's an interactive course. It mixes video, roundtable discussions, Slack debates, assignments, peer grading, marking, everything you could expect, and one-to-one coaching, of course. So there's lots of project management training out there that doesn't really cater for the not so ideal scenarios, you know. It makes it, and we're in danger of doing that. I've done that on the show before, you know. Oh, yes, you should do all this usability testing. Yeah, but we live in the real world, you know. It doesn't always work out like that. But this particular course looks at things like tiny budgets, vague briefs, crazy clients, stupid deadlines, which that's a proper training course that teaches you that kind of stuff as well. So it's very practical and very much beyond just the theory. It's got an excellent guy behind it, a guy called Ben Aston, who is a really friendly chap. Another guy that I suspect I will be in contact with over the long term, because I love talking to him. He supports, but he's also supported by other digital project managers as well. You can find out more about this. There's an upcoming course, I think, starting on the 1st of April. So if you get a shifty on, you can find out that more about that by going to thedigitalprojectmanager.com/BoagWorld.
I wonder if...
Right, Carl.
Sorry, I've just got to... I was just sorry, wondering, this shifty, is that something that translates around the world? You've got to get a shifty on.
Shifty on. Does that even translate in English?
I think it does.
I'm not sure
maybe
it does.
It's southern England, maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Shifty on. Carl, have you any idea what we're talking about?
Is this like some sort of dirty English slang or something?
No.
No. It I don't know where it comes from, actually. It means get a move on, you know, hurry up.
Oh, but, okay.
But I don't know where it comes from. That's really interesting.
Right, okay, you guys talk. I'll go
there. You go. Yeah, find out the source of it. Right, Carl. So, I mean, we've already touched on this a little bit, but I want to delve into it a little bit more, right? So, there will be countless people listening to this now who work in an agency or freelancers who've all toyed with the idea of creating a SaaS product, right? We tried to do it at Headscape and we crashed and burned horribly. Now, it sounds like you crashed and burned a few times and didn't give up.
Yeah.
So I'm really interested in that process, everything related to that process, you know. So, you know, how did you fund that initial prototyping? How did you find time alongside your agency work? You know, how did you make it happen? We tried to do Get Sign Off, right, which was our tool. And it was like 2 years of faffing, basically, and trying to do it alongside business. How did you make this happen, Carl?
Well, I remember when you were working on Get Sign Off, and I'd even signed up for the early beta, and I followed that whole story. So I actually used your example and the, I think, the post-mortem that you had. Yeah, well, hey, I mean, I learned from some things from the lessons that you shared on your blog. So so in a way, I benefited from your experience with Get Sign Off. I'm sure that doesn't offer any comfort to you.
Alongside the 10% of all sales of Proposify, that's fine. Yeah, that's good.
Sure thing. We'll get our lawyers on that.
Distant past, Kyle. Don't worry about it. It's been a different life.
No, but I mean, Paul, you had said something in that post around how you really need to get a dedicated developer working on it. You can't just make it a project within your agency because it just always will go to the back burner and client demands will always override your internal product. And that was really what we had experienced trying to work on multiple products. We were maniacs trying to work on three or four different products at a time. But when we really focused on Proposify, we had to actually, and we're lucky, we live in Canada where there are government programs, grant programs, where if you're working on technology product, you can apply for these and they can even help fund and cover some of your developer salary. That's kind of stuff generally doesn't exist in the US, but it may in Britain, because I think we're kind of a little bit more.
Yeah, it does.
A little bit more English.
Yeah.
So we took advantage of that. I mean, of course, we had to reinvest money from the agency to work on the product, but really it's just a matter of focusing for a very long time and not giving up, because when we had launched our product initially, we had this fantasy in our head that, oh, we'll get 10 customers and then the next month we'll get 50 and then it'll just grow. And then eventually we'll be able to turn down client work. And it's not,
we
really
drew a graph like that never happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody's drawn that graph before. And I think because we've all looked at the Jason Fried, DHH Basecamp model, that is, sounds like that's kind of what worked for them. But in our experience, we realized we had to, shit or get off the pot, for lack of a better term, and focus on the product. If we believed in it and wanted to do it, we had to get rid of our agency. So it took 10 months and it was horrible, but we actually sold our agency, didn't make a cent off the sale, but we were freed up just to work on the product.
So you took, because that was one of the things I was going to ask, is about the decision to drop client work. You went cold turkey, from the sounds of it, that before Proposify was profitable, was this?
Yeah. I mean, we were also lucky in the sense that we didn't have a very profitable agency, so it wasn't
easier decision.
It wasn't like we had this it wasn't like we had this lucrative agency that was just, you know, lining our pockets and we had to, you know, make the hard decision to turn that down. We were struggling at the agency. We were always one payroll away from missing it. You know what I mean? Like, we were always chasing after clients, and trying to sell a crap business like that was difficult because the buyers, you know, they were looking at our finances and our balance sheet, and they knew that, like, we had good bones, I guess, as a business. Like, we did some nice work. We had a good team. We had clients, but we weren't, you know, that turnkey business that they could just buy and they were going to have to do a lot of work to it. So we were more or less looking for them to just pay off some of our debts and take it over.
Yeah.
I mean, that was different to us at the time. That was probably when we were turning over the most we've ever turned over. I'm not sure it was the most profitable we've ever been. I don't think it was, because we were growing more than we wanted to be, or more than we realized, but we were turning over a lot and there was a lot of work on. So as clients were demanding and things, and, you know, there were political things internally as well, but it just, I think that was the problem that we faced. We were just never going to turn away from this thing that was good. That's it, really.
So how many of you was there when you started up Proposify? It was you and Kevin, who is your co-founder. And Kevin's not a technical person, is that correct? He's more of a business markety kind of person.
Yeah, yeah. The sort of divide between us, Kevin, if you will, is kind of the Marcus of the partnership, and I'm the Paul, I guess. I'm the design product person. I also do a lot of marketing and SEO kind of stuff. Those are the things that I've, you know, done historically. And Kevin's much more operations, finance, you know, legal, basically everything else that's not product and market, sales. So that that's a pretty good divide for our partnership.
And so when you started Proposify, was it just the two of you when you first went, or was there more?
Well, I can't code very well, so we had a really good developer named Jonathan who built the product from day one, and he's our CTO now. So it was really the three. We were a trio, like leaving that agency, which Jonathan was never really a part of. He always just worked on the product. So the three of us left, and we raised a small seed round of funding that basically kept our rent paid for 10 months while we were trying to still find some product market fit and grow. And thankfully, we went from, you know, 10 customers to 11 the next month to 8 the next month, and really struggling even after we left the agency. But finally, by about October 2014, we noticed we had doubled our customers. And then the month after that, we doubled, and it started to really quickly grow. And so we became a bootstrap profitable company within a year from then.
Fantastic.
Wow. So that is excellent. So with the seed funding that you took, I'm quite curious about all of this, because I lived through the .com.
Yeah.
And so it has made me pathologically paranoid and negative towards anybody that takes any kind of funding at all, which I know is fundamentally wrong, but it's amazing how the past can scar you bitterly. How did that come about? How did you find somebody for that kind of thing? Where'd you look?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I've always been a little wary of funding myself, because of those same reasons, especially venture capital, which is a very different kind of investor, where they're looking for that, you know, just, you know, put fuel in the gas tank and just grow. Don't worry about profitability, and then hope for, you know, the next round of funding to come along when your burn rate's, you know, incredibly high.
Yeah.
Those are, you know, that's always what we've been afraid of, and also losing control of the business, because investors typically take board seats. So I think we're kind of halfway in agreement there. Big difference for us was our first round of funding was a government-based venture capital firm. So they had a bit more of an economic development incentive to put money into the company. They're not kind of like the sharks down in Silicon Valley that are looking to, you know, build the next Dropbox or Uber. So that was nice. And they also they took board seats, but they were very much hands off and just kind of let us run the business. So that was great. That was our first round of funding. And then we avoided funding for a very long time. When we started to grow fast, people were pushing us like, go out and raise, you know, it may not be there if you wait, or if your growth starts to die down. And we were stubbornly resisting that for a long time.
So you obviously changed your mind at some point, and you have got additional funding. What changed, and how have you approached it?
Well, we knew that the company was profitable. We have, you know, good culture here. We're happy. So it sort of begs the question of, like, are, you know, people, especially investors, look for that eventual acquisition or that big payoff down the line? And I think what changed for Kevin and I was we read that article. I know I've brought these guys up a ton already, but Jason Fried and DHH wrote this article about why they took Jeff Bezos' investment. And the big thing for them was they wanted to take secondary capital, meaning instead of the investor putting the capital into the business, they were actually selling their shares and kind of cashing out, in a sense, if you will, even though they were retaining ownership in the business. And when Kevin and I read that, we thought, hey, I wonder if anybody would be open to that style of investment where they put cash into the business, but Kevin and I are also able to sell some of our shares. And that way, you know, we kind of have a mini payoff now. We can buy houses or build houses and have some money to invest and save long term. And it sort of frees us up of not feeling like we're tied to, like, we need to get this business acquired.
Yeah. So that's an interesting one, the whole thing about your exit strategy. We have Headscape, we have a non-executive director of the company who was always encouraging us to have an exit strategy, which we is he? Bless him. Which we mock him tirelessly for, because we've always wanted to build a lifestyle business. What was your ambitions, and what are your ambitions now in that regards? Do you see yourself working on Proposify in 20 years, or do you want it to be acquired at some point? And has that changed?
Huge amount of money.
Yeah, you know. yeah, it would obviously have to be, right? I think that when you take on investors, you're obligated to grow the business so that it can be sold one day. You know, if we were to tell our investors, you know what, we just want to run this for the next 20 years, we don't want to go public or get acquired, they'd be pretty upset with us, because like that's why they invest in the company, is to make a return on it. They know it'll be probably a 10-year investment, but there has to be an exit strategy. And it's a lot easier with SaaS, because you can get ridiculous multiples on revenue. If you're trying to sell an agency business, you can maybe hope for 1 to 2x on revenue, assuming your books are in very good shape and you've got great systems that are repeatable. But a SaaS business, you can get 10x multiples, 5x multiples. GitHub sold for 32x their revenue to Microsoft. It was just ridiculous. So you always have to, I think, kind of think about getting acquired one day. But if we build a good business, and I actually kind of avoid the term lifestyle business, because I think that we can still have a growing business and live a great lifestyle and not be overworked and have freedom to travel and do what we want. I don't know what the future holds. Like, we just know we want to grow the business. We want to create a great business and a great lifestyle for our employees and ourselves. And I think we can have it both ways.
I think it's possible too. But I think Paul started off by saying you're living the dream. It sounds like you actually are, which is great.
It is nice. I mean, to Paul's point earlier, like, of course you have to still work on product. You never build a product once and then sell it for the next 10 years. You're constantly working on it. People sometimes ask, why do you have a big development team? Isn't the product done? And it's like, no, it's the backlog of bugs, the backlog of feature requests. It's a huge, huge thing. But I think the nice thing and why it's living the dream is we're never at the whims of one client. If the customer base as a whole says, we want this, then we build it. But we're never at the mercy of one client who says, change all the buttons to red because it's our brand color and we have to do it. And that's the freedom that we enjoy.
So, but I mean, the flip side of that, mine, is that you are constantly having to market and promote and push the application all of the time. I'm interested. It sounds like you do a lot of that kind of work now. What's your marketing strategy?
Yeah. Well, we have a great team of marketers. We have about 10 people on our marketing team who do everything from creating content to managing paid media spends to, just even bridging data becomes a big job, you know, somebody to run your analytics and make sure, you know, customer data is getting pushed through all the right pipelines and into Salesforce and all that stuff. There's a lot to be done from a marketing standpoint. The thing that I didn't really expect getting into this is that we would build a sales team and have people, you know, doing outbound cold calling and running demos.
Right.
And making that a big part of our growth plan. Didn't anticipate that from the beginning, but that becomes so important as you move up market and sell to bigger clients. And that's something it's kind of overwhelming, to be honest.
I'm quite interested in that, in terms of things that you didn't expect going into this, you know, because obviously we're all of us, you know, if those of us that come from an agency background, when you first start doing a SaaS type project, we're quite naive, aren't we? And I'm interested to hear where you think you were naive going in, looking back at it.
Well, I mean, we were just trying to survive another day. We didn't really have this grand vision, you know, so I'm pretty scrappy and a bit of a hustler. So I was, you know, tinkering with code and designing screens and doing customer support and doing marketing and blogging and trying to do it all for a very long time from that standpoint. Of course, working with Jonathan and Kevin. But I think the surprising thing is that as the company grows and as you start to see some success, your job as the founder or the CEO becomes a lot more about managing people, hiring the right people and making sure they're working at capacity, communication with the team, like even just how do we do an all hands meeting with 65 people? You know, what do we communicate to them? And everybody I've talked to, especially in the SaaS world who run even larger SaaS businesses, and I'm sure it's the same with an agency, is that people and communication become your number one challenge and your number one job. It's a lot less, you know, the hands-on working on product, working on marketing. It's all about, you know, this team isn't, you know, they missed this important piece of information that wasn't communicated. How do we solve that communication challenge the next time?
How does that feel, Mike, from, you know, someone who's come from a design background, do you miss the kind of hands-on design and the fact that now you're having to deal with maternity leave and sick leave and you know, people arguing with one another about the next... Yeah, people. I've got a problem with people. Yeah, but do you miss that? This is why I work by myself now. Do you miss that kind of design side of things? Or has moving into a managerial role felt very natural to you?
Yeah, great question. You know, as far as the HR stuff, we do have HR people who manage a lot of that stuff. So I don't think I would be very good at that. I'm not great at the touchy-feely stuff. Kevin is really good. People, he's like a bartender. Everybody just trusts Kevin and tells them all their worries and whatnot. But I think the thing that surprised me about, like, how do you run a larger company is that you don't actually manage 65 people. You manage about 5 people who in turn have their direct reports. So as long as you hire good leaders for departments and have your one-on-ones and make sure you give them clear goals and expectations, that kind of stuff kind of works itself out. There's not a lot of managing people. But I guess to the question about design, I still love design. I don't enjoy the actual pushing of pixels anymore. I've realized about myself that I'm very lazy and I like to come up with the general idea and direction and do some whiteboarding and brainstorm. But when it comes to actually implementing it, I'm like, okay, there's more talented people over here who will do a better job. I'll come in at the end and say like, oh yeah, that's great.
It's interesting because we spoke to Jeremy Keith on Tuesday. And he's, even though he was saying that he doesn't really do any kind of serious project code work all the time, he still dips his hand in from time to time. But he said with Andy, his partner, like the day that Clear Left started, he flipped from, he never coded any CSS ever again. And this was the guy that wrote CSS Mastery, wasn't it? And he just, I'm going to be a businessman now. Yeah. And I think it's just different people for different things, isn't it? Some people can take on a new role, or it might have been the thing they were always wanting to do. Whereas others, like Jeremy, is a tinkerer, isn't he? He's a futurist almost.
Yeah.
And he was never going to stop doing that. He was just doing the same thing, and then he carried on doing it in Clear Left. So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah. And you know, that's been a hard transition, I think, for our CTO, Jonathan, because he's just such a skilled programmer, and he loves to do it. So as the development team has grown, he's been pushed a lot more by me to be more of a manager and come up with, set the vision, set the direction, but don't try to do all the work. You know, don't take all those monkeys and put them on your back. And by monkeys, I mean problems, challenges, not people.
Not stuff.
But, you know, that's so common, and it's a big challenge for people who are doers and executors to move into that management position, because they're so used to, oh, I can do that, I can solve that. And it's like, no, you have to learn how to delegate and trust your team to deliver.
The slight confusion that I'm having here is you've listed quite a lot of things that you don't do anymore, right? You've got a marketing team, right? You've got an HR team. You only manage about 5 people. You don't do any design work. What do you do? On a daily basis, what actually does a CEO of a startup do?
Yeah, I mean, so I appear on podcasts like this. I actually had 2 others scheduled for today, but that's not a common day. I just, you know, it just worked out that way. a lot of meetings, you know, between one-on-ones with your reports. We have a weekly leadership meeting where we run through metrics and you know, a monthly all-hands meeting. So it's a lot of meeting stuff, which, you know, is good, I guess. I think the thing that I've really enjoyed is the fact that I don't have to be here 9 to 5. You know, I have to do my meetings. Yeah. I have to do my calls. But, you know, it's nice to be freed up and, you know, take the morning out and spend it with my family or go to the gym or whatever I want to do. Definitely a much more freedom. And it's because I have the HR team and the development team and the marketing team. If anything, I would probably slow the business down if I got into the marketing team and said, okay, let's, you know, let's do this, let's do that. They're quite happy to have me out of that. But, you know, I do what I can to, you know, whether it's sitting on podcasts, creating videos and content for the marketing team to promote. You know, I try to stick in my lane and do what I'm best at.
Yeah. Okay, that's kind of interesting. So if you do your job right, you shouldn't be doing a huge amount, really. You should be thinking, I guess, about the future a lot and where Proposify is going to go and those kinds of things.
Yeah, you know, there's a great quote by Quentin Tarantino that I like to use on that, because there's a fascinating, I don't know, I find him a very interesting guy, and I've heard him on an interview talking about how when he met Terry Gilliam, the director, in the early days before he had directed anything, he kind of asked, like, how do you get all your films to look a certain way and they all have a consistent style? And what Terry Gilliam told Quentin Tarantino was, it's not your job to execute or create a film. It's your job to have a vision and then hire smart, talented people to execute your vision. And so that's what Quentin Tarantino did. He didn't know anything about film stock or cameras or lighting, but he knew what he wanted from his films, and he knew how to hire the people who could do the job. And I view being a entrepreneur and founder the exact same way. It's not my job to execute the business. It's simply to have a vision, set a clear direction, measure it, and get the right people in the right seats.
Fantastic.
So how do you do that? Because, that, you know, it's easy to say, isn't it? But, you know, how are you forming your vision for Proposify going forward? What is your vision for Proposify going forward? And then secondly, recruiting is not an easy process. So, you know, how do you approach that in a particular way? Where do you find people? Are you a remote company? Wow, there's about half a dozen questions
talking.
In
stop
there.
Talking,
pick something and answer it. Yeah.
I'll pick a couple of those questions. So we've always been a not remote company. We're based in Halifax, Nova Scotia, which is in Eastern Canada. But we've actually started to experiment a little bit with some remote roles just out of necessity. We had a great engineer who had to move across the country to Vancouver. We have a salesperson down in New York just to do some higher touch sales down there. We're even looking at opening an Australian office just to cover time zones. So we're sort of getting into the remote space a bit. I mean, as far as coming up with a vision is the hard thing. And that's where when people say, what do you do every day? It's like, well, I could be walking in the woods, or I could be at the gym or somewhere, and it's probably a better environment for me to sort of noodle things and think about the market, read things and try to learn. The company would benefit more from me doing that than sitting here in the office, you know, writing a blog post or writing some code. So I think that you have to, as a business owner, you have to free yourself up and not chain yourself to your desk, so that you have that space to go away and think about things. And then you can come back with some clarity and say, okay, you know, here's where I think we're going as a company.
That's a tricky thing to do, mine, isn't it? Especially after, you know, you've obviously, in those early years, as you're growing very rapidly and you don't have that team around you, you are the HR department, you are the marketing department, you are all of these things. Mm-hmm. And so you're constantly having to hustle. And you said that yourself earlier, that you're very much a scrapper, a hustler. And now you're not doing that kind of thing. You're having to step back. It's interesting to look back again at Jeremy Keith, who we were interviewing on Tuesday. He said he feels a constant sense of guilt because he doesn't feel like he's doing a proper job. Do you have a sense of that in a way?
I used to. I have less and less as time goes on, because the thing is, who am I guilty to? You know, my board and my investors are happy if the business is growing. They don't care when I show up. The team, you know, as long as they can get time with me to meet and talk about things, they don't care if I'm in at 9 or if I'm gone at 3 in the afternoon. It really does, you know, you have to kind of think, who do I feel guilty towards, right? Mm. You, myself. Now, if you are like me, I think having some side hustles and some passion projects is important. I wrote a book last year, and just doing little things like that that kind of keep you on the ground. But yeah, no, I mean, I think taking some space away and not having the business not require you just means that you can sell it one day, and the business doesn't rely on you.
One thing I'm interested to say is you say you've got maybe there's 5 people that report to you. One of those is, I assume, Jonathan, the CTO. Those other people are absolutely, you know, they're so important to your business. I mean, did they kind of grow with you, or did you just hire them off, you know, from a recruiter? I'm interested where that, because we've always had a, you know, back in the day when we were thinking about growing, we're not thinking that way at all now. It was always a case of, well, we need to get more help with sales, and da da da. And we always felt that we couldn't, we didn't feel we could kind of fully trust people in those kind of roles. So I'm just interested to find out where, how you found those people, because they're basically running your business for you, from what you've said.
Yeah. Yeah. So the people that report to me are our CMO, our CCO, which is our chief communication officer, our chief of product, Ricky, and Jonathan, and also our VP of customer success. So those 5 people report to me. And then a few others report to Kevin, VP of sales, head of HR, okay, that kind of thing. And yeah, to find those people, most of the people that report to me are actually people who were with us from, you know, maybe year one. They were our first 5 hires, and they're people that have had to level up over time. That, I think, is one of the biggest challenges of getting people who are scrappy and doers like yourself, and then putting them in managerial roles. They really have to evolve into that. And the same way I struggle and you struggle as founders to delegate and trust people to lead, your people who report to you have to do that too. And so you have to be coaching them to say, look, Ricky or Jonathan, stop writing that code, you know, trust your team. Like, coaching them to success to become leaders is an important job for you as the founder. And if you can't find those people, or they just don't exist, then you have to go and hire them. And we've done that with our VP of sales, our VP of customer success. And that's actually a lot easier to just go out and hire somebody who's done it before. You pay a lot more for them. And, you know, the downside of it is, I guess, they're not, you have to make sure they're a good cultural fit. And it's easy when you're leveling up your people who have been with you, because they're part of the culture. They help form that culture. Bringing in somebody from outside, there's always the worry that, are they going to contribute to the culture, or are they too different? That's, you know, there's a challenge on both sides.
Well, I think I can take from all of this, which I hadn't thought of before for this call, is if the business is successful and it's moving along nicely and everyone enjoys their role, then people can adapt and, you know, they can grow with the business as the business grows, which that's a new thought for me today. So that's great.
Or they don't, and you have to let them go. And that's the hard thing too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Very interesting conversation, Carl. I could keep going on that one, but we're kind of out of time. Really nice to talk to someone that has done that transition from an agency to a SaaS project, a product, and that journey is really interesting to hear. I do want to mention our second sponsor, which actually dovetails nicely with Proposify, because you've got Proposify that wins you the work. Then immediately after winning your work, you've got to sort out contracts, which are always the horrible bit. And if you're running a freelancer or a small business owner, lawyers to look at contracts, it doesn't happen, does it? I couldn't justify going out to a lawyer every time I had a contract I had to sign. And so, you know, we make educated guesses, don't we, as to whether, you know, that looks okay. So Packly is about helping our users understand their contracts, right? So that it's not this kind of big scary thing that you just sign and hope for the best. You know, we shouldn't be treating our business contracts like we do our iTunes terms and conditions, you know?
Accept.
Sorry, Marcus, you were going to say?
Automatically. Accept
yeah,
yes,
just
whatever.
Accept. Yeah, yeah. So there must be a better way of doing it, and that's what Packly basically does. So you can submit a contract, say like an NDA or some form of contract, to the system, and it will flag anything that looks a bit dodgy or a little, you know, unconventional about it. And then you can go back and you can discuss that with your potential client. You could get a couple of reviews per month absolutely free, so you can give it a go. And it just works very quickly because, you know, they've got an algorithm that knows how to look at these things in seconds rather than... Even just reading them can take hours, can't it, because of all the legalese. So really great way of doing it. They're offering us a code. So if you do sign up for one of their paid plans, if you use the code BOAGWORLD, you get 30% off the lifetime of using them, which I always like. I don't like it when they give you a discount that only applies for a few months and then suddenly they hike the price up on you. But you can always try it on the free plan first. So you can find out more by going to pac.sg/BOAGWORLD. And good luck to them, because I think that is a flipping useful thing to have. So, yes. Right, well, Carl, because you have listened to this show for so long, you know the horror that is Marcus's joke that's coming next.
Oh, it's the best part.
Hey. Well, I'm going to... I'm going to continue on the Tim Vine theme. So it's going to be poor... because I'm delivering it, but it's very short. So here we go. I was getting into my car.
Okay.
And this bloke says to me, "Can you give me a lift?" And I said, "Sure, you look great. The world's your oyster. Go for it." Oh, dear.
I think I've heard that
I started repeating myself. I probably have.
I don't know. Well, I mean, there are other sources of jokes in my life beyond
just you, Marcus.
It might have
actually been
Tim
Vine himself. You know, it could have been.
Could have been
the great man.
Could have been. So, going from first of all, Carl.
Yeah,
thank
great
you
to meet
so
you, Carl.
Much.
Really,
thank
good
you so much for coming on the show.
Likewise, quite an honor. Thanks for having me.
And also, thank you for all your support over the years. You know, I know that. You know, when you've sponsored the show, it's been as much out of love for the show as it has been for the sponsorship. Because I know you won't have made a lot of money out of my motley crew of listeners.
We were the difference, Paul. Come on.
So
we were the thing that kicked it over.
We
the,
were what?
The tipping point.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, Shopify. Mm-hmm. I remember when Shopify sponsored this, and that was back, you know, when I was listening to it a lot. I think 10 years ago, and look how Shopify turned out. So I thought I need to follow in their footsteps.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's the place to start. Let's put it like that. And then you quickly abandon us when you get too big, because, you know, let's be realistic. There's better ways of spending your money, isn't there? Success starts here. Paul has just said in the chat room, "Bullshit to that." Is what I'm calling. Anyway, so thank you, Carl, for joining us on the show. Next week, we're being joined by Brooke Baldwin, who is a user researcher from Facebook. And she is the reason that we're doing this season of the show, because I heard her give a talk where I thought, bloody hell, I didn't know that job existed. And that made me want to start talking to people more about their jobs. I knew user researchers existed, but you wait till you hear her on the show and you'll see quite why I'm so fascinated by her job. It'll be a great show, so join us then. But for now, thank you for listening and goodbye. Oh,